The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, author Scott Shapiro on the best and worst hacker movies.
If you believe that mass surveillance of people in the United States by the intelligence community is a serious problem, then it really behooves you to actually get your facts even mildly straight. And that's what I found so unbelievably upsetting about the Snowden movie. That's what makes war games so special, because it taught us what to be afraid of, as opposed to tapping into what we were already afraid of. To preface our discussion, you will not learn how hacking works from the movies. You cannot trust what you see in Hollywood.
Spoiler alert. Scott Shapiro, welcome to Chatter.
Thank you so much for having me, Shane. I'm really happy to be here.
This is great. This is great. We're talking in the middle of a very slow news week.
Yeah, almost nothing has happened. There was one submersible on, but
yeah, that's it.
That was a short story.
Exactly. Right. You know, it was totally like we've moved on from that. But no, we're I am joining you from Washington, where I'm actually in the newsroom of the Post today. And are you up in New Haven? Would I have that?
Yeah,
or have you
decamped? Right now I'm in an undisclosed location in New York City. During the semester in the school year, I'm up in New Haven.
Right. And for those who don't know, Scott, you are a professor of philosophy at the Yale Law School and director of the Yale Center for Law and Philosophy at Yale's Cybersecurity Lab. How are law, philosophy, and cybersecurity all connected? I mean, that's a combo.
Yeah. So, you know, everything is connected. I wish I could have said that
like the internets.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I wish I could have said that in a Matthew McConaughey voice. So one of the things in this new book that I just published, Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, what I try to show is that we always focus on cybersecurity as though it were a technical problem that requires a technical solution, but rather, the claim of the book is that cybersecurity really ought to be seen primarily as like a human political problem, and the law can be incredibly useful for helping change the incentives that people have for creating bad code. So law plays a very fundamental role. And also another thing that I try to argue is that hackers don't just exploit technical computer code, but they also manipulate the philosophical principles of computation. Mm-hmm. And so the book is it's a story of five hacks, but it's also a story, an explanation of how these technologies work and why and how law and various rules affect how we all act with our computers, and how philosophy matters deeply for understanding at a very general, high, abstract level, how all this stuff works.
It's a fascinating book. And listeners of the Lawfare podcast, if you haven't had a chance to check out Scott's interview with Jack Goldsmith, where they go through the book, it's really worth your time. And it's a really engaging conversation and an outstanding book, too. We are going to go decidedly more lowbrow in this podcast. We're going to talk about movies. Listeners know, my favorite subject. And the reason I had reached out to Scott to ask you on is you mentioned one of my favorite all time, you know, I guess we could call it hacker movies, War Games, in the book as kind of being prototype is the wrong word, but important film in the history of computer hacking. So we're going to talk about that and some other hacker movies, maybe hacker TV shows, maybe some real bombs out there in the hacker genre. Yeah, but before we do that, just briefly tell us a little bit. You've talked about like your work at Yale and how these different fields intertwine. You write about that in the book. How did you get interested in hacking and hackers?
Yes, sure. So I have a technical background. When I was young, I grew up during the personal computer revolution. So, all through high school, I coded, and then I studied in computer science. And in college, I had a computer company. So I did about 10 years of serious coding. And then,
was this like in the 90s, or like when did you graduate high school?
Yeah, I graduated 82.
Okay.
And then, so it really was when the Apple II and the TRS-80, all those things had come out. But I stopped in the beginning of the 90s, thinking that my future lay in jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. So I went to law school and got a PhD in philosophy. And then the previous book that I had written with my colleague, Ona Hathaway, was called The Internationalist, and it was a history of the laws of war over 400 years, and from 1600 to 2014. And people kept on asking me, well, what about cyber war? What about cyber war? What about the next phase? So I started doing research in cyber war. And despite the fact that I have a very strong background, technically, I found the whole discussion completely opaque, very confusing. And I tried to figure out, like, whoa, how does hacking work? And can hacking be an act of war? And what is this whole world like? And why is it so hard to figure out as somebody who, like myself, was pretty educated in the fundamentals, I couldn't figure it out. So that's how I got into the whole thing. And I will just say, just to preface our discussion, you will not learn how hacking works from the movies.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Yes.
You may think you've learned how it works from the movies.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You cannot trust what you see in Hollywood. Not always.
Sometimes it's fake. Theme of this podcast.
Yes. Sometimes it's fake news.
Exactly. Nevertheless, I mean, Hollywood does on occasion try to project the image of the hacker onto the big screen. It is usually pretty cringe-inducing. Not always, though. And there are some of these films that are great entertainment and do kind of capture the zeitgeist as well, even if they don't necessarily get all of the technical details right. So why don't we just, what should we jump in?
Let's just jump, because I mean, War Games is like the origin story for a lot of what's going on. And so let's talk about that.
So War Games, for those who don't remember or didn't, criminally, if you have not seen this movie, stop the podcast now and go watch it. No, just kidding.
Absolutely.
1983, directed by John Badham, who also directed A Saturday Night Fever, for those who don't know, starring Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy, with some great supporting roles, including by Dabney Coleman, who we'll talk about, I'm sure, in the discussion. War Games, the premise of it, just to refresh everybody, is this teenager who is, I think he's basically actually in like Silicon Valley, right? He's like in Sunnyvale, California, played by Matthew Broderick. He's this sort of, you know, autodidact, we might even call him a hacker, prototypical, who's kind of, you know, terrible in school. So he does things like breaks into the school grading system and changes all his grades to an A. And through a wild sequence of events, which Scott, maybe you can explain in some more detail, accidentally ends up basically tapping into NORAD and the U.S. Strategic Missile Command and nearly starts World War III. Great premise for a film. So talk about this as kind of like the OG hacker film.
Yeah, so I will, but I also want to just state that when you the way the movie opens is a kind of human in the loop.
Oh yes,
problem, which is really incredibly
interesting.
That.
It's such a good opening. Yeah, talk about.
Yeah, it's such a good opening, and it's also really relevant to what we're worried about right now, not just in cyber when we talk about AI. So the movie is opens up in there are these two maybe men in their 20s, and they're in the military, and they go into a silo, and all of a sudden there's a warning that Russian missiles are incoming, and they have to decide, is this real or not? It's very interesting because there are like very subtle things that happen where one person says to the other, oh, like he tried to buy marijuana. And then you're thinking to yourself, oh, that's interesting. So like he at the time, of course, marijuana is illegal. As it is still some places, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, that's interesting. You like the guy who's in charge of stopping World War III has been smoking dope on the weekend. And so you're whatever. Okay.
They're just like bantering in the missile silo. Right. And with all the computer banks everywhere. Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden it happens and they have their authentication, two men, the two person scheme, and they break open the codes, and the guy who had smoked weed because maybe he was a bit chill, he says he decides not to turn the key and launch, and it turns out to be a false signal, a false alarm. And so a big theme in the movie is, do we want computers to be set up so that they are automatic? Because one of the things that the computer scientist in this film represents, there are Dabney Coleman. There are two computer scientists. One is Dabney Coleman, who's he believes that the failure of the humans to actually launch shows that there's a vulnerability which should be patched by having a computer do the launch codes the launchers automatically once the president has signed off on it. Don't want humans in the loop. And you're supposed to think that this seems like a very bad idea not to have humans in the loop. And the other computer scientist, who's the genius, Dr. Falcon, he's the one who is the human with Matthew Broderick who will eventually stop it. So the first thing to appreciate is it's so current, because the concern seems to be about artificial intelligence and the ways in which automation may make us much more unsafe in the name of security. Mm-hmm. So we want to beat the Russians, and yet we're putting ourselves at the mercy of these computers that we can't control. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, so Matthew Broderick is great. It really is the stereotype of the hacker, but in this case, it probably is a more accurate young, adolescent, high school, doesn't really pay attention to schoolwork, much more interested in playing with computers, and does what is now called war dialing. The technique is called war dialing, which is based on the technique that Matthew Broderick uses. The name of his character is David Lightman. What he does is he takes a modem, and he has a program which will generate random phone numbers, and then we'll dial them automatically, see if they're picked up by some remote computer. And if they are, he'll try to break into it, either because there's no authentication, no security, or there's security that he guesses. So this is actually when Target was breached in 2013, I believe it was because a guy was driving around from Target to Target, randomly dialing Target numbers in the parking lot of Targets, and was able to breach a contractor and get in. So he's
pulling a Matthew Broderick.
It's he's pulling a Matthew Broderick. And the difference, the reason why this is so OG is because not only is this a first time that you really kind of see hacking in a major motion picture, but somebody watches it before it comes out, and his name is Ronald Reagan, and he's president of the United States, and he sees it the Friday before it comes out, and he has a meeting with George Chief of Staff and the top people in Congress in his office the next week, and he's like, hey, I just saw this movie called War Games. You think that this can happen? And he tasks the military to try to figure out where this can happen. And the general comes back, presumably reporting that for 20 years, the military has been very concerned with exactly this scenario, and says, Mr. President, we have a lot of work to do.
That sounds like a scene in a movie too, right?
Yes, I mean, exactly.
And like how perfect too that Reagan, who, you know, obviously he was an actor, and you know, if you talk to people who worked with him or you read biographies of him, he related through story. He related through allegory. I mean, seeing a movie and that prompting a policy question is like, that is classic Reagan. That kind of thing happened frequently. And this was, you know, and this movie was, I mean, it was, it's in the film, you know, it, he, Matthew Broderick's character essentially, you know, accesses this computer you're talking about, which has the great name, the Whopper, which stands for War Operation Plan Response. It's not the Burger King hamburger. Right. You know, and in the movie, it's like this big kind of black mainframe with this like HAL 9000 kind of looking eyes on it and whatever. And it's meant to be both like somewhat put you at ease, but also be kind of menacing. But the fact that he can, Matthew Broderick can get into it, and the conflict of the movie is that he basically, you know, sort of tricks the United States computer system into thinking that Russia is firing nuclear missiles at the U.S., which would then, of course, trigger, which they're not. But then the fear is that that would trigger an actual response by the U.S. and ignite World War III. So you can just imagine height of the Cold War, peak nuclear tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States. And the president sees this film and is rather alarmed by it.
It is amazing that it never occurred to him that it might just be a movie. That is, it like whether computers are capable of this kind of very high level reasoning that I think we would be astonished today if GPT-4 could do. What the movie presents is a situation where anyone can get into NORAD. There's a secret artificial intelligence program that for some reason the genius computer scientist who built it decided never to disconnect it, didn't shut down the back door, and has astonishing reasoning capacity, like things that you would be shocked if ChatGPT-3 and kind of the AI bots that we've been using now could figure out that, you know, for example, that thermonuclear war cannot be played successfully, that it could figure that out is really, it would be remarkable if computers now could do it. It was certainly impossible back then. So it's an incredibly important historical artifact because this is what gets the ball rolling and leads to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986, which is the main federal statute against hacking. For the hearings on hacking laws, the chair of the committee played 3 minutes of War Games to as congressional testimony. It just shows how backwards and how unfamiliar everyone was with this new digital ecosystem. What's really interesting is the fact that some genius computer scientist would create something so ahead of its time and then hook it up to a real system, missile system, forget it's there, not remove the back door, is just so beyond astonishing, and would have the password be Joshua, not even any special characters.
Right. Who's the dead son of the guy who invented it? Yeah, it's just all too easy.
It's all too easy. So, I mean, it's highly unrealistic, but it was salutary in the sense that it got people interested.
There's a great scene that kind of gets at the idea, like, the machine is out of control, we can't control it. So they get to the end of this thing and they feel like they have averted the crisis, and the Whopper starts basically taking over again. And they're all popping champagne corks at NORAD. And, you know, the general, just who's been running this whole thing, just says, just unplug the goddamn thing. And then Dabney Cole was like, that won't work, General. Right. So it really, it is the machine taking over. And then, you know, they have to basically teach it in the end that strategic nuclear war is an unwinnable contest. And then Joshua, who is this, the computer actually talks, has this great line where he says, this is a strange game. The only way to win is not to play, which of course is the moral lesson of the film about the futility of nuclear war, which is the broader picture that the movie's trying to make, but not necessarily, I think, the reason we all remember it.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, by the way, to see these movies from the 1980s, because you forget how much, like, the whole culture hated the Russians, you know, the Soviets, the Soviets. They were unbelievably ruthless, terrible. And then when you get into the 2000s, we start seeing the enemies of the United States change. But it is kind of, from a national security perspective, you know, you think to yourself, okay, who have we decided is our main geopolitical enemy? And we're going to make them the villain in the film.
Right. Exactly. Fun little point of trivia about the movie, too. The two guys in the missile silo in the beginning who kind of lead off in the prologue, played by Michael Madsen and John Spencer. So Michael Madsen of Quentin Tarantino film fame, and John Spencer, best known as Leo McGarry, the White House chief of staff on The West Wing. So relatively unknown actors at the time, but they went on to bigger things. Yeah. Let's talk about another movie that comes out, you know, a good 10 years later or so after War Games, called Sneakers, which I have to say, Sneakers kind of rates is one of my favorite spy movies of all time, or like at least intrigue movies. Movies directed by Phil Alden Robinson, who did Field of Dreams. And the cast, like, just this cast alone, listen to this: Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Ben Kingsley, David Strathairn, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, Mary McDonnell. Like, that is the principal ensemble cast of this film. Truly, like, some of the greatest actors in history are in this movie that is basically about a unit of operatives who are like ex-intel types, probably worked at the NSA, but many of them are computer hackers. Basic plot of the movie is they're hired to go retrieve this mysterious black box. Turns out to be like this master encryption key that can break every code known to humanity. And the people they think hired them are not really who we think they are. There are like overtones of like Julian Assange in this movie. There is like, I feel like this film was like forecasting things, you know, that would come to pass years later. But talk a little bit about your thoughts on this film, and particularly kind of like, again, the role of the hacker. And is this like more accurate to how hacking works, do you think?
Yeah. So I want to say there's so many things about this film which are interesting. As you mentioned, the cast is just crazy. All-star cast. That's the first thing. What I found, two things really struck me, and it really goes to my background. The first thing is that I cannot believe how much illegal activity they're engaged in.
We're used to seeing
criminals committing some crimes, but this is like these people who are engaged in surveillance and are considered the good guys in the film, they are just rampantly committing wiretapping fraud, trespass, like every single thing you can imagine. They are violating. And so that I found that really upsetting. So that was the first thing.
it offended your delicate sense of private security. Yes, researchers are supposed to obey the law.
Right, exactly. I mean, well, I'm not sure that they were private security researchers.
Well, that's true. But they're a private security company.
Yeah, they're a company, right. They are what we would call now pen testers.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
You hire them to break into your system to prove how you can break into it so you can better protect it.
Right. But it's, as you know, it's an unbelievably highly regulated process. Yes. And takes a long time to set up because you have to give people authorization to do that. Anyway, let me just say that, I was a bit on the legal fainting couch on that one. The second thing that I found really interesting / annoying is that, as you pointed out, the whole plot revolves around getting a black box that has some kind of encryption something, which you don't really explain, that can break all the encryption in the United States. Though the idea is supposed to be that it's supposed to break Russian encryption, but it's only useful for breaking American encryption. And so the subtext of the film is really, you can't trust the intelligence agencies. They really want to spy on Americans. Though, of course, the heroes of this movie are people who are spying on Americans. The mathematician is represented as like just an utter like flamboyant, genius diva. So the idea is that there's a mathematician in there, and he has long hair, and he speaks with a foreign accent, and has this algorithm that is going to be, he's a cryptographer, and he has this mathematical cryptographical algorithm that's going to do something that's going to break all encryption in the United States. And so that he's giving this talk, and instead of standing in front of like a PowerPoint, because I'm not sure they have PowerPoint then, but like instead of like an overlay or a screen, he's standing in front of like this projector that's just projecting mathematical symbols on him. And he doesn't actually report any results. He keeps on saying, what we will be able to do in the future, and this opens up the intriguing possibility that we'll be able to, and I thought, any mathematician that's giving a paper would never talk about the intriguing possibility that they would just show you the theorem, So like this is
that would not be for a movie, Scott.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, the idea that mathematicians are charismatic. Okay,
that's the biggest fiction of all.
Right. Or that there's like they would like build up suspense instead of just telling you the theorem. I was on my academic fainting couch for that. But what's really interesting is they don't call what they're doing hacking; they call it sneaking. And it really shows one of the things that we forget, which is that so much penetration. We always think about hackers from halfway around the world, but there are lots and lots of hacks that happen because of physical intrusion, fooling guards and getting into the building and learning about the actual authentication procedure, security procedures, and perhaps security data that will allow them to maybe hack when they're in there or hack when they're outside of it. I was just on a radio show with this woman, Jenny Radcliffe, who she's published a book called People Hacker, and this was her job is what the sneakers people did, which is that she would trick people into letting her into the to their corporate headquarters, and then would gather information once she got inside there, and her techniques were very clever. But this happens all the time in the world of security, and the people at sneakers show you how much of that would need to be done in order to get into a facility.
Yeah, and there's this great scene that is perfectly illustrates that, where Mary McDonnell, who is sort of the ex-girlfriend of the Robert Redford character, she agrees to help them by going on this date with a guy who works at the facility they're trying to break into. And the way you get in, if you're an employee there, is you go up to the computer and it scans your badge and everything, but you also have to give it a voice prompt, which is, "My voice is my passport, recognize me." And so she has to trick him into saying each of those individual words at some point during the date while she's recording them, so that they can go back and splice it together later. And there's a great scene where she's like trying to get him to say the word passport. And it's hilarious. But you're so right. Yeah. And it kind of forecasts even like Mission Impossible, where they're trying to break into the facility, the physical access component of a hacker movie.
Yeah, absolutely. But and I'm so glad you brought up that thing about the recording him saying passport, because everyone now, of course, with AI is talking about the way in which AI is going to be help us, you know, break for the first time biometric authentication. So voice cloning, deep fakes on faces, fingerprint generation. Well, you know what? Like, this movie was 1992 and they were doing that, you know, with tape recorders. Yeah. And so it is really, really interesting, you know, that these ideas were really prefigured way beforehand. And what's also incredibly interesting is that the authentication that they use are not passwords. The way they get in is they steal a card, a key card, and then record the guy's voice print. Those are two factors, things you own and things you are, which are supposed to be very, very secure. And we always think about passwords as being insecure, but passwords would have been the thing that probably would have stopped this. And so it shows the ways in which all the attacks that we're worried about now, biometric imitation, you know, these have been around for a long time. Also, I just wanted to point this out. We have learned a lot as a society about head injuries. Robert Redford is constantly being knocked unconscious for very long times repeatedly without him suffering major neurological damage. So I just want to say that, like, you can't, if you get knocked unconscious, like, that's really bad. But if you get knocked unconscious for like a couple of hours, that's like ICU. Anyway, so that let's stop that for the moment.
You are nitpicking. I love it.
I know, but you know, head injuries are really very scary, bad things, and they're not to be taken lightly.
Right.
Here's a cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name.
And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
And this movie also reminds me, there's a much earlier film, The Conversation with Gene Hackman. I don't know if you remember this movie or not, where it's a bit different. He's not a hacker. He's a surveillance operative. So his gear is all microphones and radios and things like this. And it's a great kind of 70s paranoia conspiracy film. But it also, it gets at this idea of the physicality of surveillance and of like trying to steal things from people. In his case, he has to physically get close to them or be within eyesight of them. And I think as like, for me, as hacker movies go on, and we'll get to this with the Die Hard movie, they become so all about somebody sitting in front of a computer terminal.
Yeah.
And it just becomes so remote from the physical nature of like really how espionage works and how surveillance actually does. And it just makes for a more boring movie. Like when it's just people sitting behind a computer and stuff blowing up, it's just not as exciting as, you know, watching, you know, Robert Redford try to sneak into a building or Tom Cruise like doing a trapeze number or to like, you know, steal a microchip or something.
Oh, absolutely. This is a big piece of hacker psychology, which is that if you don't see the harm you're causing or the privacy you are invading, it is so much easier to do it. So not only is it less exciting from a cinematic perspective, it's psychologically, it's much easier to do. Actually putting yourself at risk by putting your body where you can get caught, or to do something that will involve looking at somebody directly in their face and then doing something which is harmful to them, that is psychologically a much, much more difficult activity.
Yeah, and that's something that, and maybe you'll want to say a word about this. It's not a movie, but the TV series, Mr. Robot, I thought that really captured that element of it. I mean, that's a movie where it's not just about hacking, it's about the effects of hacking and the social disruption. But, you know, I think the way they were able to sustain a narrative for that long, I don't have any, I think it was like 3 or 4 seasons, was that it was not just people sitting behind terminals.
Yes, absolutely. And it wasn't actually that physical either. So one of the things that we'll get to, obviously, we can talk about Die Hard 4, which is how unrealistic it is. It's very, very hard, because hacking is a technical activity, to portray it in a way that's meaningful to the moviegoers. Because, you know, if you show people Linux command line, you know, most people are not going to know what it is, and it's not going to be interesting to them. So you have to do cinematically interesting things. And by that, I don't mean typing quickly, because that's another way you convey how good a hacker is, by how fast they type. But so the thing about Mr. Robot is that they actually had security professionals who did everything. And so it's actually enjoyable to watch it if you know what's happening, because it's fun to see the right tools and the right commands and the right switches being used. But ultimately, what I think Mr. Robot does well is that it uses music, it uses editing, and it uses plot to get you interested and to convey the suspense. So it's not that it can't be done. It's that it's much harder to do. The earlier movies, we didn't talk about hackers or, you know, kind of even earlier films that try to represent hacking, but they often represent it as though it were a video game.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of graphics, a lot of things, you know, ships passing, bombs going off, when hacking is really just looking at text command lines, just characters up and down your screen, very, very little graphics going on.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, now we have to talk about Die Hard, the next film, Live Free or Die Hard, aka Die Hard 4, 2007, directed by Len Wiseman, starring, of course, Bruce Willis, Timothy Oliphant, and Justin Long. Probably not the most memorable in the Die Hard franchise. I can't remember if it was the last one, but to situate people too, contextually, this is 2007. You know, it's 6 years after 9/11, and this is also a period in America where I think it's safe to say, and I remember as a journalist covering this, Americans are just starting to kind of become very alert and paranoid to the idea that terrorists might not blow up buildings or fly planes into them, but will get into the internet and start breaking physical infrastructure and disrupting daily life. And so Die Hard, kind of like smartly, I think, from the producers and the writers' point of view, enters this moment of kind of heightened paranoia about hacking in America in a kind of post 9/11 environment. So talk to us about this film and what it gets right and wrong.
Yeah, right. So watching it again, I hadn't realized, but the so here's the basic idea. The basic idea is you have this evil hacker, you know, somewhat demented person.
Played by Timothy Oliphant,
Timothy Oliphant, who's really great in this.
Yeah, he's terrific.
He's really terrific. He's really kind of got that cool, evil vibe down. And he is like an Edward Snowden type. So his backstory, according to the movie, is that he was security person and involved in intelligence, and then sees how the internet is really, really insecure and fights to have the United States government rebuild it or the world rebuild it, and is so upset that it's not being rebuilt, that he decides to show how easy it is to destroy the critical infrastructure of the United States. And so engages in, you know, what they call in the movie a fire sale, which is to destroy the anything that's critical infrastructure. They're going to destroy. They're going to destroy the traffic light system. They're going to destroy train system. They're going to destroy the grid, the electrical grid. They're just going to create pandemonium across the United States. And there was a great book written by a colleague of yours at the New York Times, David Sanger, called The Perfect Weapon. And it's a really great, great book about cyber conflict. And it's called The Perfect Weapon, which in a way I think is like misleading, because cyber weapons are highly imperfect. And I think that's one of the things that this movie, Die Hard 4, gets wrong. One of the things that you learn about cyber weapons is that they are very system specific. They're hyper specialized, and they are designed to exploit something about somebody's setup that has some vulnerability. And so it turns out that you can hack into, let's say, a security camera setup. In my book, the Mirai botnet involves infiltrating security cameras. It's also possible to infiltrate, at least theoretically, traffic system for a major metropolitan area.
Right.
What seems very highly unlikely is that you can do this in New York, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles. That is that each of them are going to have very different configurations, and it's highly likely you're going to have a whole suite of these tools in order to hack into the digital infrastructure of the United States, because we have a federal system and states have, you know, basically control their critical infrastructure and localities. They control their critical infrastructure. There's some, obviously, guidance at state and federal level. But, you know, the nice thing about the United States is that, like, it's a choose-your-own-adventure. And so that means that to hack all of it would be an unbelievably difficult thing to do. Another thing that you see in the movie is that somehow – every single system has the same user interface or GUI, graphical user interface. And so like any terrorist can just jump on the computer and like go into Boston's traffic system and change it, as if like the Boston system probably has its own setup and it probably has 1,000 glitches that you have to learn. And the idea that anybody could just jump into a system and start playing around with it, even if they had gotten unauthorized access, that's just highly unrealistic.
Yeah, it's a feature of the worst hacker movies that they treat the internet like it's this centrally controlled device that has a single point of access, which is, of course, I think just like playing on the public paranoia that that's what the internet is. It's like the Whopper. It's this machine that's doing things and you can't see it. I mean, The Net with Sandra Bullock, like great example of just like out of control, stupid paranoia about like, you know, like, I mean, they can track you everywhere. It's like Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman as a kind of another example in the genre. But it's so interesting to me because like, they're not great movies, but they do speak to like in a kind of zeitgeisty way about what is terrifying Americans at the time. Possibly like what people like, frankly, in my profession are maybe misleading them about what they should be scared about. And so like, I look at like Live Free or Die Hard and it feels like an opportunistic film. It's like, let's make a movie right now about what's scaring the crap out of people. Computers, hackers, turning the traffic lights off. And in that sense, like, yeah, it's well executed and it's well acted. It also makes me think that there's an interesting little parallel to draw in the second Die Hard film. There's arguably an example of hacking, although maybe in a more analog way, that is actually, frankly, it's terrifying, and you could not do this after 9/11. But I don't know if you remember this, but the villains in that movie they physically tap into the cables that run into the air traffic control system, I think of the New York airport. So they basically take over air traffic control for the airport. And they have their demands and they're holding the city hostage. And to demonstrate what they're capable of and the lengths they're willing to go, there's this terrible snowstorm because it's Die Hard, it's happening at Christmas. And they basically, they short circuit the tower. So they're the ones talking to this plane that's trying to land. And they trick the plane's guidance system into thinking that it's actually 200 feet higher in the air than it is. So they crash the plane and they kill everyone on the plane. And it, I mean, it's utterly terrifying. And like, you right. can't, like, the scale of violence and that it's an airplane, again, you have a hard time doing it. But that's actually more accurate in terms of the way you would have to pinpoint it. Like, you got to get into this wire that goes to this place, block this communication.
Yes.
As opposed to, you know, the whole, like, just break into the internet model.
So I absolutely agree with everything you said. And just to pick up, that's what makes war games so special, because it taught us what to be afraid of, as opposed to tapping into what we were already afraid of. And that's the mark of a great movie or book or something like that, is to get you to care about something you didn't know you cared about. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I think that one of the things that the movie taps into is that the analog guy, the older guy, in some sense, is always the hero, the guy that can figure it out. So John McClane, no more analog guy than that.
Yep.
But somehow he stops the hackers. Same thing about sneakers. Robert Redford is mainly, I mean, he hacks, but he's mainly a physical intrusion person. And there's this way in which we as moviegoers kind of trust that the old tried and trusted ways will actually save us from these newfangled technologies.
Yeah. No, it's interesting how few writers seem to really kind of nail it. I mean, we've talked about like war games and sneakers as being great examples of the genre. Live Free or Die Hard. Yeah, it's kind of mixed. Let's bring us to the last film on our list. This is 2016's Snowden, directed by Oliver Stone. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the star playing Snowden. Shailene Woodley, Melissa Leo, and Zachary Quinto. Excellent cast of actors. This film, I think we both agree, sucks. This film is terrible.
Yeah, right. But can we agree that it's so bad it's good?
It's so bad it's good. Yes, okay. 100%. I will just say, like, for my part, I remember watching this movie in the theater and frankly being skeptical, because it's directed by Oliver Stone, who has lost his mind and had lost his mind long before he made the Snowden film.
Right.
We could all say some words about Oliver Stone maybe in a bit, but really thinking like, God, this is not going to be good. It's, and just being mesmerized by how bad it was. I would say, just from this from the standpoint of two, of like, of just how not only did it seem to misrepresent Snowden, but just like this bizarro, like, paranoid culture of intelligence and all the things that Oliver Stone is kind of imagining about this world, when, you know, actually, had you just kind of stuck to more of the real story, it's pretty compelling. You can watch the documentary Citizen Four by Laura Poitras, who is portrayed in the film, by the way, by Melissa Leo. And the film is clearly very sympathetic to Snowden, but it's a nail biter of a movie. It just kind of just follows the drama as it unfolded. Whereas, you know, Snowden, that is one of my chief complaints about it, is just that, frankly, that Oliver Stone made it. But talk about Snowden and your special love hate for this film.
Yeah. So I was going to say, again, I really agree with you. Like, why'd they have to gild the lily?
Yeah.
So I thought it was horrible. I thought it was horrible because it like took like a bunch of numbers, like 215-702, section 215, section 702, scary names like muscular and X key score, and then put it in a blender. and then poured it on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So like the first thing you get when Snowden learns about the vast NSA capabilities, he's shown X key score. So X key score is a database of takes from the intelligence community that is accessible to certain analysts who have privileges to look at it. And one of the things that this kind of pivotal part in the movie is when Snowden is involved in some field operation and this NSA analyst says, "Hey, come over. I'll show you everything about everything in the world. And I'll show you women getting undressed, a Muslim woman getting undressed." And of course, Snowden is mesmerized that there is a database that has information about everyone in the world. That's what is being portrayed as if there's right. everyone in the world. And then he says, "How is this possible?" Right? Because I would like to know that too. How is this right. possible? And what does the analyst say? He says, "Oh, it's all bulk collection." Mm-hmm. Right? So now, obviously, you know, but for, and I'm sure a lot of Lawfare listeners know, but Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the business records provision, was used for a bunch of years under Bush and then under Obama as hoovering up telephone records and the metadata associated with it. And that there were kind of rules about when you were allowed to look at this database. There were very few people who were allowed to look at this database, but it was just the metadata. And just the metadata, it's, you know, through various types of analysis, you can learn a lot from metadata. But what the analyst proceeded to show Snowden was not metadata. It was the actual contents of the communications. And just there seemed to be no limit to where this analyst could go. He's targeting a U.S. person, somebody who is in Oakland. Like this mm-hmm. is not, this is like a very serious infraction. What I thought was the most interesting thing is that there's absolutely no oversight. Like yeah. this person is just acting as though the NSA, we're not a security organization. Like there's right. just no way. Right. It's not like the NSA cares about privacy per se, but it's not going to give an analyst unfettered access to all the information. That's a huge security risk. When he keeps on asking more about all this information, the analyst starts throwing out other names. They're saying, "Oh, Muscular, Prism, Upstream." Now, these are all Section 702, not bulk collection, but targeted collection, which is extraordinarily different. And so that really, you know, if you believe that mass surveillance of people in the United States by the intelligence community is a serious problem, then it really behooves you to actually get your facts even mildly straight.
Right.
And that's what I found so unbelievably upsetting about the movie.
And this is, and I think this, frankly, this brings me back to Oliver Stone. I mean, Oliver Stone doesn't care about getting the facts straight, right? I mean, and it's really, I mean, the movie I think we can go back to is kind of like what in a way sets this up is the movie JFK, which, I mean, we won't have to spend any time talking about that. But, you know, I mean, it's a preposterous film. I mean, it is like every bizarro conspiracy theory that has been debunked, you know, on the JFK assassination poured into a 3.5-hour movie, which, by the way, is a mesmerizing film. I mean, it's an incredibly, like, if you just forget about reality for a minute and or for 3.5 hours and follow along with another all-star cast, it is a riveting movie. But like, it's riveting in the way that, you know, and I don't know if you ever saw this, there's a documentary made after 9/11 that circulated on the internet called Loose Change, which was like basically a homemade documentary about how 9/11 was an inside job. It's insane. It's incredibly compelling. So I think that Snowden suffers from this same problem that Oliver Stone is getting at, which is that he has an idea about how things work. He has a point he's trying to make, and he roots a narrative in history and says, "Screw the facts." And I think, you know, the danger of a film like this is that people go to see Snowden and they think, oh, so that's what this was all about. Like, that's what his exposure was all about. That's what this all means, because it's, you know, it's a mass market film, as opposed to like going and seeing Citizen Four, maybe, and getting a, but maybe at least more factually based idea. That actually gives us the opportunity to come back to, okay, so what did Snowden reveal?
Yes, please.
And it's so interesting because I was covering this having just written a book about surveillance called The Watchers,
right,
which had come out a year or two before the Snowden leaks. And the first thing I thought when I was seeing some of the documents that he disclosed, and I wasn't at the Post at the time where he gave some of them, was, I think I wrote about this all in my book. Like, this is, I mean,
right.
We knew a lot of this, right?
Right, right.
You know, the initial leak about the court authorization regarding, I think it was like bulk collection, there was some newness to that, and arguably some very deep public interest, you know, journalism in that. And that, as it was, you know, it was exposing things people didn't know about that were potentially, you know, legally dubious. But as, you know, as the more and more of the documents came out, I mean, and I was covering this at the time, kind of like two big overarching points, one that I realized at the time and one that I don't think I appreciated till later. One was that most of this stuff was PowerPoint presentations. It was internal documents that, yes, referred to real programs and actual things that may have been going on, but they were arguably exaggerating some of the capabilities, possibly because these were made by people who were trying to impress their bosses and get their programs funded. Right. So to say nothing of the expansiveness of NSA surveillance that it showed, which I think, you know, we kind of all understood, frankly, and I had written a book about, a lot of these, I was looking at these PowerPoint documents and thinking to myself, we should not just be taking these as journalists as gospel and writing off these the way we'd be writing off of, like, this isn't the Pentagon Papers necessarily, right? This isn't the WikiLeaks cables, which showed actual documentation by people in the State Department talking to each other in real time. And I don't think journalists were skeptical enough of some of the documentation. That's one. The second thing, I didn't appreciate this till later, is what it actually showed, and this is going to make me sound like an NSA apologist, I know, that the NSA has an enormous and robust legal compliance division within the agency. Some of the things that were revealed about excesses by the documents that NSA accesses were actually things that the NSA had caught because of its compliance architecture, which is not to say that it's not perfect, that it's perfect, but there is basically a huge division of lawyers that are there to make sure that the NSA stays within the legal lines, which is not something that I think is a story that was really fully fleshed out in the midst of all of the reporting, some of which, including my own, I will say, was overheated.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad I agree with you because you're the expert on this. I would say that one of the things that was definitely portrayed in the media, and it is a big part of the Snowden film that Oliver Stone presenting, is the idea that the NSA hacks other countries a lot. Mm-hmm. That's something that everyone should know. Like, that's like, maybe you should have learned it in, maybe it should be taught in high school, mm-hmm. which is that there's this executive order called 12333 that basically gives the NSA carte blanche to hack outside of the United States. And so the fact that operational details of this come out in the Snowden revelations, that's of course new and bad, the details, but the fact that the NSA is doing its job should not have been new for people. The thing that I think was really new, and this goes to what you were saying about the initial revelations about the Verizon order for Section 215, the bulk collection, and then Section 702, the second story, which was Section 702 targeted collection from social media companies like Google. I think what they revealed was that there was secret law being made by the federal, by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And people knew that business records were being collected. They just didn't know that all of them were being collected.
Right.
And they also didn't know the kind of expansive interpretations of Section 702 that were allowing NSA to legally do what they were doing. And so if anything, I feel like what Snowden, the big value added that Snowden contributed was to basically tell us that the Obama administration was hacking, so to speak, the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Mm-hmm. They were using the secrecy provisions to push the boundaries of legal interpretation such that people didn't know what the law in fact authorized or not. I think it's important to say that the rule of law does not require that we know what the NSA is doing, but we have to be able to know what we're allowing the NSA to do in order to know whether we should continue to allow them to do it. And the fact that a secret court was basically acting as a regulator of domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence surveillance, it was really bad. That having been said, I think it's really important when you point to the PowerPoint slides and you say, actually, you see that there are all these safeguards that are on the slide. So like in Snowden, the NSA analyst just types in some keywords and see what pops up, whereas the Snowden PowerPoint deck had slides showing about the rather complicated oversight procedure that tasking anyone has to go through. So by the Snowden's own revelations, there was a significant amount of oversight to what analysts were doing. So in a way that the film, Oliver Stone's film, is not even true to the things that Snowden revealed.
Yeah, that's what's so maybe ultimately so disappointing about the movie, because you know, you had this, you know, esteemed director and you had this big Hollywood budget and these actors, is that it's such a letdown, because it undermines in so many ways the real story of what Snowden was about. And it is an important story. I mean, there are things that Edward Snowden revealed that the public deserved to know. There are things that he added to our understanding about the expansiveness and the potential dangers, and in some cases, the real excesses of government surveillance and authority that the public has a right to know. The movie just doesn't do that. And I think I'll pick on Oliver Stone. Why not? I feel like hands of a different director and different writer, there was a real opportunity to make a film that was not only more honest about the facts, but actually was more educational.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in some ways, Snowden is like a great example of, you know, of a Hollywood disaster story, which is when people try to take on a fictionalized version of real and important events and just get it so terribly wrong. And then, you know, no one's going to want to pick this up again. Like no one's going to, I mean, it would take a lot. It would be a very heavy lift to get another Edward Snowden movie, you know, made at this point. Yeah. And it's just kind of such a shame that Oliver Stone kind of, you know, wrecked it.
Right. No.
Because, yeah.
Absolutely. And let's not forget, like, I mean, well, I think he identifies being on the left. It's really interesting, you know, in the Trump era with QAnon and conspiracy theories and anti-vaxxers and all RFK Jr. and all this stuff, that this was going on in the left. By the way, I identify as center left. So for people on the left, there was this very strong conspiracy theory movement, and we forget that that there was just a lot of crazy things being said about what Bush was doing, what the government was doing, and the mess we find ourselves in now has been brewing for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. As we wrap up here, just say a word, because I mean, you are an academic, you're a researcher and a scholar. Just say a word about, and this is probably what you learned in writing your book, what does the academic research tell us on what hackers are really like? And we've talked about now fictional portrayals in several films and TV shows, but what does the research show is kind of your typical characteristics of a hacker?
Thanks for asking that, because I think it's really important. Again, we were talking about Oliver Stone and facts, so it would be good for me to present the facts, at least as the research presents it. So I think that there's a very big difference between hackers from Eastern Europe and hackers from Western Europe in the United States. In the West, hackers tend to be much younger. They almost always are boys. They're almost always boys because people get into hacking through gaming, cheat sheets and game modifications, and that draws them into the world of hacking. And the world of gaming is highly misogynistic. It's getting better, but the whole Gamergate thing meant that the people who were on the pathway to hacking got a kind of selected to be basically male. That's the first thing. Number two is they really are highly social online. They run the gamut of psychological profiles, so they're not all have multiple personality disorders like the person in Mr. Robot does. Some are good, some are bad. They're not all geniuses. They typically age out. So, 18, 19, 20, 21, they get bored of it and they move on. It's the very, very few who kind of get caught up in it and stay caught up in it. That's unusual. In the East, in Eastern Europe, they tend to be much older hackers, cyber criminals. And the reason is because so many people from Eastern Europe, it's the problem of underemployment, overeducation. So these are people, they don't have Googles or Metas or Twitters to go to. So there are some tech companies, but like most of them are doing IT if they can get it. And they're trying to make money on the side. The people who are involved in it feel like, okay, if I hack people in the West, I make some money. It's not a particularly interesting way to make money. Alice Hutchings, the director of Cybercrime Center up at Cambridge, has a great article called "Cybercrime is Boring." It's just like dealing with customer service requests and managing databases. People do it for the money. And so the idea of like the romantic figure who's in his basement and is overweight with a hoodie, that's, you know, there are some people like that, but that's not how hacking and security works. Hacking and security works normally through teams. In legitimate industry, they're bigger teams. In the illegitimate industry, they're smaller teams, but they tend to be teams and they work together. And at least for people in lesser developed tech economies, they tend to be older and are there just to make some money.
And do we know, I mean, maybe this is hard to get at from a research perspective, but hackers who go to work for the government, right, who go to work for Cyber Command or NSA or the CIA, do we know if they follow the same kind of type and they just find their way into public service?
Yeah, so one of the things that has happened in the last 5 years is that different countries, the UK, the Netherlands, the United States, have built these diversion programs for young hackers. They've built competitions, Capture the Flag, Cyber Patriot programs, where they're trying to get these young hackers into the legitimate cybersecurity industry so that their skills can be used for, the good side rather than the bad side. So they are definitely being brought into it. The last hack in the book, the Mirai botnet, those three young men were then, instead of being incarcerated, they were given 5 years community service and had been working with the FBI to catch cyber criminals, and they're out on parole and end of October. So I think that that's a great model for using people who have these skills and have made bad choices, that they can be used to redeem their behavior. But that really only applies for those who show the ability to do it and who don't have a host of other problems, like problems with chemical dependency and things like that.
I think you got the makings of a good movie right there, you know, or a series. It's like Breaking Bad meets Mr. Robot. You know, who knows? I mean, there's somebody in the right hands, this could be a very good story, actually.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Well, our tradition here on Chatter, Scott, is that the very last question we ask one of our guests is a question, pre-written question that we select at random from the Chatter box, which, because I'm in the office today, is actually an envelope. So I'm going to reach in here. I'm shuffling the questions up. I'm going to pull one of these questions out, and I'm going to ask you at random. Okay, this is a pretty good one, too, because this maybe gets away from the hacker discussion. What common misperception about your profession makes your blood boil? What do people get wrong about and take profession, however, which of your many hats you want to wear?
Oh, yeah. I guess I wouldn't say my blood boil, but it irritates me.
Yeah.
People think that I just, like, I'm a teacher. And I am a teacher. I teach. But that's like 2% of my job. I teach, so this coming semester I'll be teaching 3 hours a week. So you're like, what do you do the other 37 hours? Most of my job is research and talking to people about research and writing. And so when people say, oh, so you're off for the summer. No, I'm not off for the summer. The summer is when I get to do the job that I'm supposed to do. That I haven't been able to do. I love teaching, and I think teaching is, a great calling, and it is a calling. But most of my job is not that. It's shit posting on Twitter. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. I meant writing.
You meant on Blue Sky,
writing scholarly work to edify the information society.
Well, in your spare time, I'm glad you could come on here with me and talk about movies we love and hate.
Yes,
It's been a ton of fun. Scott Shapiro, the book is Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, The Dark History of the Information Age in 5 Extraordinary Hacks. You should check it out. It's a great read. Read more about war games. We'll put links to all the movies we discussed in the show notes. Scott, thanks for coming on Chatter. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Shane. I really, really enjoyed myself.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at ThatWasChatter.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.